Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Joining us now is Parag Khanna, the founder, managing partner of Future Map, also the author of The Future is Asian.
Good morning, Glenn. How's it going?
Great. It's great to have you on. I see you're in transit.
Yeah, you caught me. I mean, I would like to say I fit the typical profile of your listener in between my morning exercise and, you know, having a coffee. So, but I'm in the great outdoors. And what's not to love about that?
Good for you. Parag, for years now, you have been looking to kind of identify governments around the world that have the most effective institutional design, and then further taking those lessons and seeing how you might apply them to the U.S. And you've been slightly controversial. You've written about this in years past. And now, this topic is coming back to the fore based on election 2020. Give us a little bit of background about what you've been looking at in relation to this.
Well, I'm not sure if anything that I've ever said is controversial as compared to the reality of what, you know, we're experiencing in terms of the sort of degeneration and decay, you know, of the American political process by now, irrespective of who wrote what when. And first, the fact is that at this point, there's a general consensus that not only is the political process broken down, but there is a significant need to reinvent the institutions. And this is the difference between politics and policy. And of course, in an election year, and it seems like every year is an election year in America, really, because either you've gotten elected or you're struggling or trying to get reelected. And as we know, the reelection begins as soon as one election is over. So it's hard to disentangle these two, but we have literally an intellectual, a moral, and in a way, a political obligation to do so, because if you're only looking at the here and now and today, you're missing the bigger picture, right? You're looking at the trees and you're missing the forest. And the forest is, you know, burning in some ways. And what I and others do is to try and look at, you know, how do you save the forest, right? You know, how do you replant the trees and what kinds of trees should we replant? You know, what should the future, in other words, institutions look like? How do you evolve them? And that may seem like lofty stuff, but it actually comes down to things that, and this is kind of the results of the fruits of labor that many people have dug into, but we have decades worth of very solid, sensible proposals about how to reform the institutions of American government, right? Whether it's the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, how would you reinvent them, redesign them, update them, even the Constitution, the process of amending the Constitution. And the fact is these things haven't gotten done.
Talking with Parag Khanna, of course, the founder and managing partner at FutureMap. Parag, great topic, great suggestions, but how the heck is any of this going to get through a Congress that can't even decide what its next step is going to be in a COVID-19 bill to give people, you know, to help people out during these financial times? It's a tough order in a Congress that is very divided.
These are, you know, symptomatic, right? These failures to be able to pass small policy, you know, initiatives in a timely way, whether it is the COVID bailout and so forth. So what has to happen, I suppose, to be very realistic initially, is that you would have to have a significant majority in the House, or, you know, a decent majority. You have to have a majority in the Senate that could end the filibuster, and certain small things like this that unlock the opportunity for long-term reforms, you know, around how legislation is made, around getting money out of, you know, politics, around, you know, certain term limits and, you know, these kinds of big picture reforms, obviously abolishing the Electoral College, so on and so forth, right? This also all goes, it presumes that there is some kind of a consensus around what I and many others consider to be pragmatic ideas. But in the real world, of course, we don't really have that consensus yet. However, you still need that supermajority, if you will, if you want to actually get some of those things done and push the kind of, you know, turn the super tanker in a certain direction.
Yeah, Parag, in the final years of the Obama administration, you were trying to look at this institutional design, and you came up with some writing, The Technocracy in America, The Rise of the Info State. Now, first of all, what did you find during those later years in the Obama administration that you thought could be changed, and what led you to this technocracy in America, and what does that actually mean?
Well, of course, you know, the title is a play on Tocqueville's famous Democracy in America, written more than 200 years ago, but stands really as, you know, a seminal text in observing American political culture and democratic culture. And so what I wanted to argue, again, is sort of an evolutionary way. What does the future state look like that fuses democracy as we know it, as we practice it in an electoral sense, with technocracy, which is a combination of factors. It is having an independent and meritocratic civil service, the likes of which we know here in Singapore, but also data. And the role of data as a 21st century way of ingesting information and sentiment about what people want. You know, irrespective of whether you're having elections every 4 years or 5 years, you can know on an ongoing basis. And that is the beauty of data, the power of data when used well. And I wanted to tie all these threads together and apply that to systems of government. Now, some countries already do these things well. So in the book, you know, the kind of iconic example of direct democracy fused with data is Switzerland. Right. Switzerland has plebiscites for every possible, interest or interest group. There's petitioning and so forth all the time, every couple of weeks, and referenda and so forth. And when it comes to technocracy, Singapore is obviously a global archetype. So what I did was I kind of took the best practices of Singapore and Switzerland, mashed them up, and then created an organizational chart for the United States government that takes the existing institutions and kind of updates them in that way. So it called for, here's one of the examples, you know, why does a country have one president, at least in a presidential system, right, or even in a parliamentary system? The truth is that if you were to start from scratch, you would probably say, well, we should have a committee of people representing diverse stakeholders in society and maybe political parties and have something of a council. Well, Switzerland already has that. It's called the Federal Executive Council, right? There's seven presidents at any given time, and only one of them on a rotating basis happens to be the sort of head of that council. Mm. And they represent different political parties. So you always have to have consensus in policymaking. So that's an example. You know, there's ideas in there that are more radical, like I say we should abolish the U.S. Senate and replace it with what I call the Assembly of Governors. Now, states are very important in America in a federalized system with these very distinct large population centers. The governors are the ones with their ears to the ground. They know how to actually run bureaucracies, right, and how to administer programs. Whereas senators are representatives, which is obviously an important function,
sure,
but it's already done by the House. Anyway, without going into all of the detail, these are all examples of how to think big about institutional redesign. And that's the kind of thinking that is needed within the United States right now.
We're talking with Parag Khanna. And Parag, when you look at, for example, Switzerland and Singapore, I mean, the example, it is really hard to make that an apples-to-apples comparison with the U.S. for so many obvious reasons. Is it fair to try to intersperse or overlay those systems to look at reform? I mean, how realistic is that, you know, looking at the federalist system that Switzerland has? Of course, you've got the different chambers and the cantons are very powerful in Switzerland. Here in Singapore, more of the parliamentary system, you know, very different to what's been going on in the U.S., and not to mention the homogeneity of the small populations in Switzerland and Singapore versus the diversity and the large scale 300 million plus people in the U.S., it would be really hard to make any of those types of major systemic changes, would it not? I mean, if not,
it's a common refrain that, you know, small countries can't teach big countries or big countries have nothing to learn from small countries. It's not at all remotely true. And the seminal example of that is China. You know, as we all know, part of the inspiration for China's reforms going back to the 1970s is, of course, Singapore. So the largest country, the largest, most populous civilization and empire in human history has been inspired by one of the world's smallest countries, which is this one, right? So let's not pretend for a moment that there can't be some kind of inspirational effect. This is also not about copying models wholesale, right? It's actually just about adaptation.
Sure.
It's about taking each place's. America has its initial conditions. It has the state of affairs and institutions and politics as it is right now. It's not about making America like Singapore,
yeah,
or like Switzerland or like Germany. However, I do spend a lot of time looking at Germany. Germany is a large country. It's obviously only one-fourth as populous as the United States. Hmm. It's certainly a very large Western democratic industrial state. And Germany does a lot of these things around how to amend its constitution, how to modify the relationship between the different chambers of the legislature, and so on and so forth. And there's plenty to learn from that too. So big countries can learn from small countries. When you're talking about adapting data, and data is free, it's not really about cost or scale. It's about a political will and a desire to actually do something. If a country wants to digitize its health records, it can do that even if it's a big country, right? China is not as wealthy per capita as the United States, but they're digitizing their health records. Of course, they have a certain approach to data that is not commensurate with American, you know, values, but it doesn't mean that the idea of digitizing health records for public benefit is not a good thing and something that you need to find a way to do irrespective of what your political system is. So I see no reason why the largest countries in the world can't learn lessons from the smallest countries and vice versa. So I think that's almost a non-starter of a, you know, sort of a rejoinder.
Sure. I got a question in, coming across on Facebook from Don Pierce, one of our regular listeners. You may have met Don when he was based here at the embassy 5 years ago or so, Parag. And now in Washington, and he is asking, how about term limits? Is that one of the logical changes that you feel should be made to the U.S. system at this point?
No question. And let's just take the immediate example of the Supreme Court, right? Now, we can remember the last two very recent instances of a justice being brought in at the tail end of an administration and, you know, people being up in arms on opposite sides around whether or not, you know, which party or which Congress, so to speak, be part of that process. Now, of course, if you had term limits for justices, that would be much easier because, you know, you have a 10-year appointment and it expires when it expires, and we don't know who's going to be in power. And so you take from a principle standpoint, you say, we're imposing this now because we can't really know who will benefit from this at a random point in future time. And therefore, it's a neutral, objective kind of decision. So it should be done, of course, for justices of the Supreme Court. It should be done, of course, for elected members of the legislature as well, the House or the Senate. And probably, and this is an area that, quite frankly, not nearly enough people are talking about because it seems so impossible, but it should be done for the President of the United States, right? A one-year term. It could be 6 years. It could be whatever years. I don't really care. Mm. It's the principle that matters. And there is certainly there's a growing momentum around this in certain intellectual circles or political circles. But again, I don't know how you get from here to there right now. But in theory, is it a very, very good idea? And does it apply across, you know, many parts of the U.S. government? Yes, it does.
Yeah, I've always felt that a 1-5-year or possibly 6-year term for president would be ideal, because the moment the president is elected, you know, within a year or so, he or she is trying to run for re-election if it's their first term, and or if it's their second term, they're a lame duck. And so everyone just kind of waits around to see who the next guy is going to be. So if they had one term, they could actually maybe get something done and with the realization that they had, you know, a fixed amount of time, and then they would, you know, have to move on. Obviously, as you mentioned, that's going to be a tough sell, I think, for a lot of people. The other thing that will come up soon now is this adding seats to the Supreme Court, which has been talked about a great deal. Is there one or two other, let's call them quick fixes in this direct technocracy model that you'd like to see that you can mention now?
Well, let's not forget when we're talking about America, it's money and politics, right?
Absolutely.
That's a critical thing that has to be dealt with. So again, many countries have shorter campaign cycles, publicly funded candidates as well. You get everyone gets the fixed amount of money to spend on advertising or printing flyers or leaflets or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And that's it, right? And this is stuff that the most advanced, sophisticated, open, liberal, democratic societies do in Europe and elsewhere. And that's obviously something that could be done in theory. It's done in practice everywhere in the world, right? So it's not one of these ideas like, oh, it's impossible, as if it's something that shouldn't be done because it isn't immediately suited to today's political environment in America, right?
Yeah.
You do face a real world choice, whether you want to have a better system or not have a better system, right? At the end of the day, that's the test that we're looking at right now. And another one, obviously, very important, is allowing multiple parties, right? Having more political parties, having at least a third party, if not more. Mm. And that's an extremely important, check and balance. And it forces, obviously, compromise, consensus and so forth. And remember that you can have votes of no confidence, snap elections in multi-party parliamentary systems. And it means that rather than having a guaranteed 4-year cycle of gridlock, You know, you can actually toss governments out much more rapidly if they're not being effective. So you're tested constantly in a multi-party parliamentary system. So I think that's another big one. But just a final point, Glenn.
Sure.
You cannot just pick one cause. You know, that's what often happens, right? And I think that's lovely that there are civic associations and political, you know, action committees whose sole purpose is to fix one or the other thing. But remember that these are all interconnected, right? They all literally affect each other and react to each other and maneuver around each other every single day. You literally do have to, you know, fix them all at the same time to some degree, at least on paper, which is why it does come back to the topic we're on right now, which is design, right? You design the system in a new way so that these different fixes fit together and create a whole that's better and more effective than its parts.
Dr. Parag Khanna, always great to talk with you. So many interesting ideas, and I would think that most people would agree something needs to change, something needs to get fixed, because the way things are going right now, it's just not working as smoothly as it should. Founder and managing partner of Future Map, of course, the author of The Future is Asian. Thanks so much, Parag, for being with us on Weekend Mornings.
Great to join you, Glenn. Take it easy.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.